What Gerard Hindmarsh does not know about the Northwest Nelson area and the Kahurangi National Park, New Zealand's 13th and second largest, is probably not worth knowing. He's lived in Golden Bay for something like 45 years. He's been collecting stories about the places and people in the area, and he's just published his third in his Kahurangi series, Kahurangi Out West. And Gerard Hindmarsh is with me now. Hi, Gerard. How lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, it's lovely to talk to you again, Kim.
Tell me about Charlie Jacobson, who discovered uranium in the Lower Buller Gorge.
Oh, absolutely brilliant story about Charlie and his friend Fred Casson. They decided at the age of about 70 to go and find uranium because they'd been inspired by the story of an Australia which had been directed by the British Atomic Energy Commission to find uranium. Well, Jim Sweeney, a veteran prospector, went out and bagged the $25,000 pound prize almost within a year. And we're finding it at Rum Jungle. And these two codgers from Nelson, Picton, they lived, and in Wellington, they decided to go out. Anyway, they went out, Jacobson sold his boat for £200 and bought a Geiger counter. And they went out, and on their very last day around the Buller Gorge, he got out of the truck to do a pee. And, of course, took the Geiger counter with him, as you would probably, and was testing the rocks. And bingo, he found it at Batty Creek, which is just down from Hawke's Crag. Well, they went straight to Wellington in the truck on the ferry, carrying all their minerals that they'd knocked off the rock, and they were hoping for this huge prize. Well, they got a cheque in the mail, £100. They were just absolutely livid with it.
And quite a lot of money back in the day, of course.
Yeah, and they campaigned for years and finally got £400 each, you know. So I think it was probably a good solution, but the uranium in New Zealand isn't not like the quality of Australia at all, but Kahurangi, of course, is just full of minerals. It's got the entire sequence from the very start of time to the present day, all here. And so it's the obvious place to look.
Uranium ice cream was for sale in Westport, produced by the local Snowflake Ice Cream Company, Uranium Ice Cream. Who'd have thought?
Yeah, whoever thought. And took off, apparently. And Westport, you know, it's always been taken by these kind of great turns of fortune. It's going to make our fortune. And that was certainly the uranium fever swept through the town. Oh, no, it's a fascinating story. And I spent, you know, like 5 years of writing these books over 14 years. I certainly didn't do it for money, but I felt very compelled to tell these amazing stories. And before they were lost, I didn't intend to write three books, but after the first book, I just got deluged with people writing to me.
I bet.
And, you know, and I just felt that all these stories would be lost. And, you know, I'm very concerned, I don't know, it's a personal thing, that in New Zealand we're kind of getting our stories, our wilderness stories in particular, watered down, if you like. I hesitate to use the word PC, but just a quick example. I was in the doctor's surgery the other day, picked up a forest and bird. First article I came to was an article advocating that all the conservation estate be made smoke-free. And I thought, oh my goodness, is this going to be the future of our wilderness, that, you know, doc officer apprehends two people for smoking? You know, we're forgetting the kind of hardcore stories. And you know, does it matter that it used to be the best to shoot pigeons on them when they fed on the merrow berries because it gave them an exquisite taste, you know? Or if you got your shovel,
stop, Jared, you're not recommending that we go out there and shoot the korero?
No, of course not.
Or the kereru.
No, of course not. It's information that will be lost because we can't do it today. And I think the way forward is to look at our past, and the knowledge of this backcountry is phenomenal, you know. And I was just saying, I interviewed a guy from who was on a public works gang down the dry road of West Haven Inlet, and he said they used to drill a hole in the end of their shovel and fill it with linseed oil and cork it up again, and they never busted a shovel in 5 years.
Well, how would that have worked?
Well, the linseed oil filters down through the wood and lubricates it and makes it sort of supple. And, you know, we just don't have, look, I've been doing that for years since I heard that story, and I've never broken a shovel handle. You know, I was going through the diaries of, I used to be always confused by which beaches were, you know, red or brown or silver or black. And I was going through the diaries of Jack McBurney. He was a ranger up the Cobb. He got more and more intense about small things, and he eventually became an entomologist studying insects. But anyway, in his diaries, I found this amazing rote learning, and that he'd learnt in Forest Service camp to distinguish between red and brown or silver and black beech or birch, they used to call them, of course, back then. And I just have to read it out here. The bark of the red is silver. Its wood is pink, but only when it's green. The brown or silver birch quite often has black bark, but the green timber is red. Sometimes the bark of the black is white, but the timber is yellow and sometimes brown when it's green. Now, you know, I have never had a problem with beeches ever since.
I'll have to write that down. I'll have to listen back to this interview and write it down. That's hopelessly confusing at first listen, Gerard.
Yeah, I know. It really is. And, you know, and how, and these stories are fantastic for how attitudes change just in like 50 or 60 years, 70 years, like the servicemen at Unit 10, which was a top secret radar base at Pillar Point near Pooponga.
That's not where Blinking Billy is, right?
Yes, that's right. Just nestled in right beside Blinking Billy or Pillar Point Light. And, you know, the servicemen there used to practice their anti-aircraft gun on passing whales. And these whales would wash up, all shot up in Golden Bay. People used to sort of laugh about it. And I think, well, haven't things changed, you know, in such a short time? And this is what we have to sort of, you know, cherish about these things, really.
This was supposed to be a secret radar station up there at Pillar Point. But there were at least 30 men stationed there at one time, weren't they? So how secret could it have been?
Yeah, up to 40, actually. And they had personnel from Britain and Australia, radar people.
Everybody must have known.
Well, of course, everyone at Pooponga. But it was a hush-hush thing. And isn't it? It's just sort of crazy, really, so top secret. And you can't build anything out at Pooponga without someone knowing.
No.
And, of course, and everyone got in on it. And they never saw one enemy aircraft. It was to detect anything. It was used in conjunction with Stevens Island radar base, and it was to detect any invasion of the capital, really, into Cook Strait or Marlborough. And so, but they had a pretty casual time. They used to go crayfishing and fishing. Never spotted one enemy plane or ship in the whole time.
Ah, well, you see, it worked. I mean, the rationale was a World War One incident, right, when that German raider, the SMS Wolf, laid mines off the coast there, and they were meant to drift into Cook Strait, and actually ships sunk off the west coast, weren't they?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, they still, the lighthouse keepers' kids at Kaharangi used to often see these mines washed up and throw stones at them. And their father would tell them off. Oh. I remember that story. And but they laid them all off sort of Farewell Spit or Kaharangi Coast, because the current comes up from the west coast and sweeps around into Cook Strait. So that's all they had to do. And this German raider, it left port in Germany, came back about 4 years later, totally successful mission. It just used to take supplies off ships and coal and then sink them and deposit the people on islands and stuff. And it was easily the most successful raider. It went on to lay mines off North Cape. It sunk a ship. They sunk two more up in the Kermadec, and then off to Australia where they created more mayhem. But that... Captain Nestor, he was an absolute genius. He knew exactly his thing.
Do you know, Jared, I did not know that Nico lived for hundreds of years.
Yeah, and the by far the most luxuriant groves are along the Kaharangi coast. There's the big one, of course, along the last day of the Hifi. But the second one is South Head in the West Haven Inlet, and it's the most beautiful grove growing amongst these limestone outcrops, just almost solid nikau. But you can tell from the trunks that these guys have been around like way before Captain Cook sailed past. They've been here for hundreds and hundreds of years, and you can tell, of course, from the rings, although, you know, you have to be careful doing that. It's 25 years before it even grows its first ring. It just forms a bowl.
And but you mean you have to chop them down in order to age them?
No, you don't. The bowl is just the 25 years at the top.
Oh, you count the rings made by the leaves falling off?
Yeah,
right.
That's right.
Plus and 25.
The rings can form between 9 months and 3 years. You know, I've got a nikau here in perfect conditions, getting lots of sort of nitrogen and stuff. Well, that can grow 4 or 5 a year, but they're so slow growing down the coast because it's hardcore down there. And so, you know, you can say that's maybe every 2 years they're putting on a ring there down there. So it's very variable.
You're going to get more story. I mean, you can't. Even you can't have mined the whole area for stories and anecdotes and people. You're going to get other people. Don't you think there's a fourth book in the offing somewhere?
Oh, look, I sort of sometimes feel like I have to draw a line under it. I mean, my circumstances are changing. I'm going blind and with glaucoma. And I haven't got a lot of time now. The doctor told me about 10 years ago, get ready. He said, you're going to be blind in your lifetime. And I kind of developed gone into it. I'm going to develop a good attitude, and I'm sort of changing my technology to spoken and touch typing. It's hard for an old dog like me, but...
Could they do nothing about the glaucoma, Jared?
Oh, I've had 4 operations. None of them have really worked. Oh, you know, we're all got some sort of cross to bear, I guess, but I'm pretty good in every other department. But... It's just I want to adapt, and I think all the fact checking that you do with non-fiction, historical non-fiction, is very hard on your eyes. I just want to be kind of liberated from that and maybe go more back to sort of storytelling or radio or just writing more fiction stuff, maybe, you know, historical fiction. So that's where I'm going.
You'll miss getting out and about, won't you?
Well, I don't. I still get out and about all the time. It's something that I've always... It's why I left school very early, because I didn't feel like being in school, sitting down. I always wanted to be out there, you know.
Do you think you'll still be able to get out there with your eyesight fading?
Yeah, of course. I think it's only one sense. I mean, some people say blindness is overrated, don't I? And people climb Everest blind now, you know. There's blind people who have done amazing things. And I even heard from the Blind Institute the other day, there's a blind mechanic in Blenheim who puts in full-time work. You know, I mean, they've got 4 other senses. And it's amazing how they develop too, you know. It's how the others start to pick up as my sight is failing. You know, but I still have a lot of subjects in my head and books, and I'm always doing something, you know, and I'm going back to the Marquesas in a week or so to investigate stories about... I've become very enamoured with the whole sort of Polynesian navigation stories, which are just so fascinating. They're kind of like our earliest stories, but what sort of propelled people to New Zealand to want to come here to Aotearoa? And I just find all these the whole Polynesian Triangle navigation thing just utterly inspiring. I really do. There was one of the most inspiring stories. Kahamavihu, he's a Tongan navigator in 1820. He went blind, and he was sitting on a boat, and the young other navigators come up and said, "Look, we're completely lost. We don't know where we are." And this used to be quite common, actually. It wasn't like they just knew where to go. It was a lot of sort of tactical work too. And he goes over and he asks them where the sun is and where the birds are, and he said, "Oh, we're in Fijian waters." And they said, "Yeah, but we're in Fiji." He said, "Dip me in the water." So they get him by the legs and dip him under the water, keep him there for about a minute, and they pull him up. And he said, "Oh, we're going to be in Lakemba by lunchtime tomorrow." You know, their knowledge was just so amazing, and so well recorded. I think that it's just something that will transform our history of New Zealand, you know. And the Anaweka Waka, of course, was found along the
Oh,
Kahurangi
that's
coast in
right.
two.
That's right. I hope you enjoy the Marquesas, Gerard. You're a legend. It's not just me saying that. A number of listeners are telling us you are a legend. Gerard Hindmarsh, his latest is Kahurangi Out West.